Hello, this is Anne, and welcome to Somewhat Qualified with Anne and Jess.
Hi, this is Jess.
Today we are talking all about the documentary that is sweeping the nation, the Fire Festival documentary. There's actually two.
I would say it's like documentaries.
Documentaries, plural. They have real names. I believe the Hulu one is called Fire Fraud, and then Netflix has Fire, the Greatest Party But Never Happened. We will be referring to them simply as the Netflix one and the Hulu one.
For the sake of simplicity, and both names are kind of dumb, so we're gonna skip over them.
Exactly. Can you imagine if we had to actually say Fire, the Greatest Party That Never Happened every time we were mentioning that one? But anyway, what did you think of these two documentaries?
I actually really enjoyed them much more than I was expecting to. I don't even think I had realized there was two coming out until I went on Hulu and saw that they were advertising theirs, and then later on that day I saw an article about how Hulu had kind of, like, jumped the gun by releasing theirs, like, 10 days earlier than Netflix, when it was originally supposed to come out after Netflix.
Yeah.
I believe. So then that kind of got me interested in, like, the rivalry of two companies making a documentary about the exact same thing at the exact same time.
Yeah, I definitely think Hulu initially picked their release date, not realizing Netflix had a very similar documentary in the works. And then when they learned that, they were like, crap. but the general consensus, I think, seems to be watch both of them, because I think both are good and both kind of cover different sides of this Fire Festival story. And for those of you who don't know what the Fire Festival was, it was basically a luxury music festival that was not so luxury. There were numerous logistical planning issues, and it turns out that when people got there, they were staying in, you know, FEMA tents and eating cheese sandwiches, and none of the artists that were supposed to play showed up, and... I actually knew very little about it, I think, prior to the documentaries. And I definitely didn't know that it was straight-up fraud to the extent that it was. I think I just thought, oh, this is just, like, inadequate planning. But really, if they did not know that they were lying to people, they should have known that they could not deliver what they were promising. And that's part of what makes these stories so interesting.
Yeah, I believe my first... interaction with Fire was actually the weekend that it was happening. I'm not sure if I had Instagram on the day. I joined Instagram a bit late. I don't think I had Instagram on the day when they did, like, the orange tile media blitz. So I wasn't there for the initial kind of social media rush that, like, inspired so many people to buy tickets. But I just remember... Like, I have a Twitter, but I don't use it very often. But I go on there, and I, like, look at what people are saying. And I just remember seeing the cheese sandwich over and over and over and over again. And then I went and I kind of read about it. And I just kind of thought that it was funny, you know? It was kind of these, like... Mainly it was, like, wealthy people who bought tickets. So I think... It kind of made it a little bit better to laugh at, because, like, I mean, they had spent truly ludicrous amounts of money to go to this festival, and then they get there, and it's essentially just, like, a camping trip with, like...
Not even a good camping trip.
It's, like, a camping trip with the shittiest people you would ever meet in your life. And... So, I mean, yeah, no, it was funny, and then I never really thought about it in terms of, like, contextually, like, you know, how, you know, like, well, how would fraud work into it, you know, what made people want to go to this festival. I never really thought about it in those deeper terms, so it was nice to kind of watch these documentaries and think about it in a different way.
Yeah, and I think... The Netflix one, I'll be honest, I think I preferred the Netflix one. I think it is a little bit more well-rounded. The Hulu one is almost a character study in Billy McFarland, who's kind of the trickster that pulled the whole thing off. spoiler alert, he is in prison now, so maybe he didn't pull it off as well as he would have liked, but basically talking about how he was able to market this lifestyle to millennials, especially wealthy millennials, and a lot of times didn't even have the products that he was trying to sell people, and he definitely operated on this mentality of, I'll just make these grand promises and figure it out later. And up until the Fyre Festival, he had kind of been able to make stuff work that way. He had a prior venture called Magnesis that was like a luxury credit card. And the Hulu one definitely goes more into that than the Netflix one did. And I think that in some ways it was fascinating to learn about him as a character, but I also liked how the Netflix one felt more well-rounded to me. Yeah.
And Hulu's big thing, I remember, well, I think they kind of were advertising it on the basis of, well, Billy was like their big get, considering he's actually interviewed in the film. But the frustrating thing about that is he's like clearly like a narcissistic sociopath who lies with no remorse. So, you know, even, you know, they'll show, like, the interviewer asking him questions about things that he clearly lied about. And, you know, like, for example, like, a wire transfer that he, like, fraudulently, you know, like, sent out to people that never actually went through.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, just any, really, of his criminal activities. And he would stonewall it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a lot of... not only this documentary, but in a lot of journalism nowadays, in regards to, like, interviewing people that would be, like, controversial. You know, like, specifically, I remember this came up with, like, a lot of people in, like, the Trump administration, like, Steve Bannon and stuff, you know, like, unrepentantly, like, evil people. And then the journalists would go to them and be like, well, I want to figure out, like, what makes them tick. Mm-hmm. And the thing is like, it's not nearly as complex as we would like to believe it is. Like, Steve Bannon is a racist. like, you know, he's a white supremacist. He's a disgusting person. There's not a whole bunch to, like, gather from that. In the case of Billy McFarland, Billy is a liar. Billy will deflect. Billy will not answer for his actions. And it's even mentioned they have excerpts of his sentencing. And says he shows, like, a complete lack of remorse for his actions. So, I think the problem with the Hulu is they never have the big get moment that you dream of in journalism, where finally, like, you know, he breaks and he reveals something. Honestly, everything that you learn from the conversation with Billy, you could get from people who worked with him.
Mm-hmm. I think what makes that decision especially controversial is I believe Billy McFarland was paid by Hulu. And that, like, I can get from a journalistic standpoint of, like, oh, I want to get all sides of the story. I want to invite all people. I believe Hulu also did invite Ja Rule, Billy's sidekick, on as well. And then Ja Rule declined. So I can get making those offers out there, but when you're actually paying people for those interviews, especially paying someone who you know has committed all these kind of atrocious acts of fraud, then I think that reaches like a whole new level of kind of greed and disturbingness. And I think also it almost comes off as Hulu knew that maybe their documentary wouldn't be as good as the Netflix one, or, like, they were scared it wouldn't be as good as the Netflix one, and so they were like, but we actually interviewed Billy, the Netflix one did not. And it almost, to me, comes off as their sort of desperate attempt to sort of one-up Netflix, as opposed to, oh, they actually needed that interview in order to tell this story in a compelling way.
Yeah.
But one of the things I think you mentioned in some of our other off-air conversations was how this Fyre Fest fiasco, yay for alliteration, but how this is so different from other failed music festivals. So, like, Woodstock 99, I know you brought up, which was also a hot mess, but was not a hot mess in quite the same way. Or at least you don't really see people nowadays being as fascinated by that complete crisis of a music festival. So why do you think that this Firefest was so different?
I mean, I think Fyre Festival was kind of a perfect storm of things, but I think the reason why it kind of really captured the public consciousness was, I mean, certainly a large part of it was due to the audience it was affecting, but also just the culture of immediacy we have now. You know, no one could live tweet Woodstock 99.
Yeah.
But people can go, you know, to the Bahamas where they're expecting to party on a yacht with Bella Hadid, and instead they get there and there's a FEMA tent with a soaking wet mattress inside and a cheese sandwich. And, you know, just the juxtaposition of that is amazing. You know, like, it's funny.
Yeah.
Like, it's like maybe like a little bit of Schadenfreude, but it's funny and you can laugh at it and you can know that, like, nothing, like, they obviously lost a whole bunch of money, but they were never, most likely they were never in danger of actually losing their lives or anything. So I think that culture of immediacy really helped Fyre Festival become the kind of sensation that it was. And it was also, because it wasn't just, like, the cheese sandwich was where it first went viral, but there was a whole bunch of tweets from multiple people about it. There were multiple photos, there were multiple videos, there were... So I think just having so many sources into what was happening at Fyre Festival actually made it... It was almost like you got kind of got to be there and kind of experience all the discoveries of how bad it could get and along with them, but you didn't have to actually be there.
Yeah, you got it in real time. And I think you also hit on a very, very important point that this perception... And, I mean, there probably is, you know, some reason for this perception, but the perception that everyone there were these kind of filthy rich brats. And I'll be honest, there was a part of me that almost felt a twinge of guilt even watching these documentaries and being like, holy crap, these people were trapped on an island with possibly not even any, you know, enough food or water to go around. And there was a part of me that actually...
Andy King came through
and got that water. But yeah, if you have not seen the documentary, you need to so you can get that reference. I'm not going to spoil it.
Netflix one has really just a stunning work of art in the middle, a monologue that will carry us through the ages.
That moment, I think, is possibly the reason that the Netflix story, like, it is the reason they didn't need to interview Billy McFarland. Like, if you choose between an interview with Billy McFarland on Hulu or you choose the compelling ballad of Andy King over at Netflix, Netflix is going to win any day of the week. But definitely, I think a big part of this was we do live in an era that's kind of, I think at least our generation is growing compellingly, like, anti-wealth, and, like, you can, this idea of, like, well, we can just hate the wealthy people for the sake of being wealthy, which I don't know that that really existed in prior generations. I think in prior generations, we looked at wealth more as, like, well, they got that because they worked hard, and they're living the American dream.
I was like, the whole notion of wealth in recent years has kind of come into question. Like, you know, wealth originally seemed something aspirational, and now we're looking at, it's like, okay, like, should Jeff Bezos have the amount of money he has? Because there's literally no way that he could ever spend that amount of money.
Right.
He would never, he could buy ridiculous, ludicrous amounts of homes, of businesses, of cars, and he still would be ridiculously wealthy. And so it comes into question, you know, wealth has become much more of an ethics issue than I think we have before. You know, as we've become, as income inequality has become a greater issue, you know, even, you know, like, climate change, I think, has really also corresponded to, like, discussion about climate change has already corresponded, because it's, you know, who are the people who are most likely to suffer in regards to that? And it's poor people. So now, when you see someone with that amount of, like, expendable cash that they could just not even think about spending, like, $25,000 on, like, a weekend music festival, it is a little bit, like, Yeah. You're taken aback by it.
And I think, ultimately, we know that deep down we're never going to probably see Jeff Bezos, you know, get slapped in the face the way that these Fyre Festival attendees got slapped in the face, you know. And
I mean, it would be lovely.
Like, I think there these kind of symbols of extreme wealth are out there, and odds are they're going to be extremely wealthy until we die. Like, I think that's just, you know, probably how the world's going to work out. So kind of seeing this, all these anonymous people that were, you know, kind of seen as these rich spoiled brats, for better or worse, they, like, seeing them get their comeuppance, I think, was really, really satisfying for a lot of people. And seeing people be like, haha, like, you got what you deserved, or, you know, you're gonna have to deal with some of the pain or suffering that poorer people maybe have to deal with on a very regular basis. And there was a part of me, honestly, watching the documentary that was almost just like, okay, but, like, no matter how rich someone is, they don't deserve to necessarily be lied to and defrauded the way that Billy McFarland did. Especially since it's not like, you know, some heist movie where there's, like, poor people, like, getting money back to redistribute it to poor people. This was, like, another...
Oh, yeah, no, this was, like, a Robin you know? Hood, like, wealth redistribution scheme. Although, I'd say, I think you're probably a bit more, like, sympathetic towards the Instagram influencers than I am, because I'm just remembering... Mm-hmm. God, that one... She was really annoying. I think her name was, like, Alyssa Lynch. They interviewed her.
Was she one of the ones who actually did get a villa?
She was the one who they interviewed who actually, like, she did get... She was one of the few people to actually get a mansion mm-hmm. that she got to stay in. I remember, like, she's on the plane, and then she was saying, this is our private jet. She's like, that's worse than, like, low economy mm-hmm. class. And just, like... The tone of that was really kind of gross and disgusting. I mean, like, yeah, no, like, it wasn't, like, a Cessna private plane.
In some ways, I almost had more, like...
To me, I had 100 times more sympathy for, like, the Bahamian workers.
Oh, 100%.
Or even the actual employees of Fyre Media than I think I did.
I think, yeah, the Bahamian locals definitely got the shortest end of the stick by any definition, I think. There's even one really heartbreaking story about someone who, you know, she had a local restaurant down there, and they were doing the catering, mm-hmm. and she talked about how she had to dip into her personal savings to pay these people, because she's just like, you know, I live on the island with these people, I have to see them every day, I can't, you know, just live with them knowing that they worked this hard and didn't get paid. And I think they, even, like, with, it's probably them, and then maybe other employees of Fyre Media / Fyre Festival. And then I almost have some more pity for, like, the influencers, because I feel like they maybe did not have as much, like, mm-hmm. as what, by influencers, I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, like, the Kendall Jenners and Bella Hadids, but some of these people mm-hmm. that maybe were not extremely wealthy, but just, like, were really good at curating Instagram content. Mm-hmm. And, that they might have gotten to go to that more just based on that, and they weren't necessarily paying, you know, $25,000, $50,000 out of their own pocket to go to this thing. But I think, like, to me, seeing some of that, I was like, well, damn, I almost feel a little bit bad for hating on the Fyre attendees as much as I did, because it's, like, even if there was water, there was no real system for distributing the water or food or anything, and it kind of did become just, like, a free-for-all of everybody stealing whatever food they could. And so I don't think paying, you know, $50,000 to go to that, you know, at the end of the day, I think, like, what Billy did was still wrong. And it still would suck to have to go through that. but I think it definitely, like, the whole story definitely, like you said, was a perfect storm of that. That was one factor, but also the fact that it was really this kind of Instagram influencer culture that built the festival in the first place, and then to see social media kind of tear it down was really interesting.
Well, you know, we mentioned Instagram influencer culture. So how do you really think that influenced Fyre Festival? Or, you know, what do you think of Instagram influencer culture in general?
I think it's just the way our economy has evolved, and it's not necessarily a positive or negative thing, but I think the documentaries raise a lot of interesting questions about to what extent do these influencers have an obligation to kind of make sure that any product they're vouching for is legit. Because I think prior to influencer culture, there was kind of an iron curtain between sort of the journalistic critic side and then the salesman side. Yeah. So, for example, in like the YouTube beauty community, which is something I'm pretty familiar with, you know, you are either here to review products and like give your honest opinion, or you worked in advertising and your job was to sell stuff. Well, now you see a lot of these social media influencers that are trying to have a foot in both worlds at the same time.
Yeah.
And to some extent, they have built their following because initially they, you know, they weren't getting a ton of like PR packages or a ton of like paid sponsored content. They built their following by giving people content they liked. And, you know, maybe in the world of like fashion, you're not getting all that. You're just saying like, hey, I put this cool outfit together. Here's where I bought the pieces. And people start following you based on that. And then soon it gets to the point where, well, now you can monetize it. Now you have enough of a following that people will pay you to wear a certain piece of clothing or endorse a certain product. And if you've gotten that successful, I don't know that I can blame you for being like, you know, hell yeah, I'll take $10,000 for one Instagram post. If not, $10,000 is actually pretty low from what I've heard. I think a lot of people, if given the same opportunity, would probably take the $10,000 and post something on Instagram. So I don't think it's entirely fair to antagonize people for doing that, but I don't think they maybe take their sort of journalistic critic responsibility as seriously. I actually did go to like journalism school, sort of. I went to communication school, but same difference. But you know, it used to be that to work in journalism, you had a code of ethics that you were trained on. And part of it was like, yeah, you don't take money from people to say nice things. And you see so many of these people that aren't really getting that ethical background that are making their living by endorsing products. And I think that a lot of their following doesn't always know to what extent they are getting paid to say, hey, go to this festival or whatever.
Or even in the case of if they're getting paid. Because I remember the big thing initially, and it's something that the FTC has really cracked down on in the past year and a half, is simply just putting like hashtag ad or hashtag like sponsored content in like their posts that advertise things. Because when they did the initial social media blitz for Fyre Festival with the 400 influencers, models, actors all posting the Orange Child at the same time, it was just like hashtag Fyre Festival. There was actually no real indication that they were being paid for that content. And especially in the case of like, you know, like Bella Hadid and like, you know, people who actually participated in like the promo video for it. It's kind of, you know, like, not that you couldn't, like, surmise that they were getting paid, but it definitely kind of provides the sense of, like, an involvement for a lot of people, and, you know, it added, like, an air of legitimacy to it. So, I think, you know, in the case, I think the regulations that are in it now, I think it does make influencers think about things like, you know, like, do I really want to put my name behind this? Is it actually ethical for me to do this? There's also this whole thing now where, did you hear that, like, a lot of, like, people who want to be Instagram influencers are building their brand by doing fake sponsored content?
I did not know that.
Yes. So they will actually, like, do posts that include the language like similar to what an Instagram ad post would be, but the company did not contact them and ask them to do it. They're essentially just performing free advertising for the company, almost to kind of like build their resume as influencers. Mm-hmm. And then in hopes the company will eventually contact them for a deal.
Yeah. But
and I think Fyre Festival was one of the first times, I mean, on the one hand, it made the FTC crack down on regulations for Instagram influencers. But I think Fyre Festival was also a boon to advertisers in that they witnessed the power of what an Instagram influencer could do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. But I also, I do think to some extent, some of that burden of responsibility does have to go on the consumer as well. Because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, Bella Hadid is a model. Mm-hmm. It is her job to look pretty and help people sell shit. Like, mm-hmm. that is Bella Hadid's full-time job. And there's a part of me that's like, okay, well, like, yes, we can antagonize all these models. And like we were saying before, it's almost easier to antagonize them because they are, you know, have so much money and, you know. But there's also a part of me that's just like, you know what? That's her job. She shows up for photo shoots. She helps people sell shit. And I certainly don't think the models knew that Fyre would be the hot mess that it was. I think, well, at least at the time that initial thing was shot, they had every reason to believe that it would be everything Billy was promising.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that, to some extent, consumers need to stop just saying, like, oh, well, Bella Hadid's in this. It's, you know, it must be legit. Because to some, we have to also admit that, like, okay, that's Bella Hadid's full-time job. And the fact that she did her job doesn't make this company more legitimate, and we need to maybe stop looking at that as an automatic air of legitimacy. But it does also, in the old days, I feel like everyone kind of recognized models as just people who get paid to help sell shit. Mm-hmm. Whereas now we do see more models that are not just showing up to photo shoots and fashion shows and doing their job. Mm-hmm. But we see models that are endorsing products and saying, like, oh, I really like this brand. I like this face cream. I like this. I like that. And they are definitely taking, like, a much bigger role in terms of actually telling people, like, you know, like the name supplies, influencing people. And I think people sometimes don't really look at models the same way as just people who get showed up, or people who get paid to show up and look pretty, you know?
On the other hand, though, because you just talked about how they're not models anymore and they're influencers now, so to an extent, they're really not models. They mm-hmm. no longer only stand up and look pretty.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, they actively, through their own personal platforms, not even through a brand platform, which is what models do,
mm-hmm.
something under their own name and their personal page, and through their personal life that they curate for a public view,
mm-hmm.
they take on this burden. So, you know, that's also a bit different as well. Like, mm-hmm. you know, Naomi Campbell, when, you know, she was doing like a Chanel campaign in the 90s, is different than Bella Hadid doing, like, a Fiji mm-hmm. water ad on her Instagram.
Yeah, I personally think the days of, like, old-school modeling where you could have a career without being on the influencer side as well, I think those days are over. I don't think that that is even really a career anymore as much, or at least if it is a career, you don't get to, like, reach the level of, like, no, supermodel.
No, that could be true, but I feel like, okay, if we recognize that modeling is transformed as a career, then the standards that we hold models to have to transform also.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also saying, like, I think, like, part of why we didn't deal with this maybe 10, 20 years ago is people were much better at just recognize, like, at saying, you know, okay, we recognize that models are just, like, people who help sell shit. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, people kind of, I wish more people saw influencers the same way, where it doesn't necessarily have to be like a mean antagonistic thing of like, how dare you take sponsored, you know, videos, or how dare you make sponsored videos, sponsored pictures or whatever. But like, I wish more people were able to look at influencers and say like, okay, those are just people doing their job, but part of their job is taking money to help sell stuff. And I think the Fire documentary probably did, like, promote a lot of awareness among consumers in that regard as well. Mm-hmm. To just recognize that, like, okay, odds are if people, like, if Kendall Jenner posted about something, like, there is a fair chance that she got $250,000 to make that post. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of consumers didn't know that before, and now they do. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, that's just part of why this whole story is so fascinating, because people, like, this job of the Instagram influencer or the YouTube influencer didn't really exist, 10 years ago or 15 mm-hmm. years ago. And, like you said, Fire kind of proved how powerful this community can be. And also proved that the community doesn't always take their responsibility seriously to kind of only vouch for legitimate products, and also that consumers almost take these influencers a little bit too seriously.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, did you have anything else to say about the festivals or the documentaries in question, or any other interesting points you wanted to make?
I guess what I thought was beneficial about watching both Hulu and Netflix was I feel like they explore very different sides of the Fire phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Hulu, I think, is much more interested in the social media side of things. They had, like, some really good commentary from, like, different writers on, like, the whole phenomenon. I think who they have. They had a few different... They had, like, Jake Horowitz from, like, Mike.com. They had, like, Gia Tolentino. Some, like, interesting points about, you know, the whole FOMO mm-hmm. and, like, how that corresponds to millennial culture. And then they had Oren X, who was originally an employee with Buck Jerry, and he was on the social media team for Fire.
Yeah, I was going to say, Fuck Jerry is actually, like, a social media marketing firm that was hired by Fire.
That was hired by Fire to be in control of their social media. And he talked a lot about, you know, how their policies helped kind of perpetuate that fraud, because they, you know, wouldn't put updated information on the Instagram. They would still use, like, original promotional materials that were done from the original shoot that they did. No actual pictures of the site, no, like, updated information about the artists or scheduling or anything. And also how they had the policy of, you know, like, blacklisting certain words on Instagram, so, like, comments that were asking about those issues wouldn't show up, deleting any negative mm-hmm. comments. So a lot about how Fuck Jerry actually, you know, kind of to a degree actually participated in the fraud of Fire Festival. Mm-hmm. So I think that is really beneficial to learn about social media and how that perpetuated the situation. I would definitely recommend watching Hulu. Netflix is really interesting because Netflix focuses a bit more on actual production logistics and how essentially no one really believed at the beginning that they could get this done, because everyone said it would take 12 to 18 months to actually realistically plan this festival, and they were starting out 6 months ahead, and then 2 months out they had to switch the island because Billy McFarland's an idiot.
It all gets back to because Billy McFarland is an idiot.
Is the short version of the story.
And also because Ja Rule is an idiot.
And also because Ja Rule is... Yeah, Ja Rule, like, really gets off scot-free in this whole scenario. He essentially... Because Fire Festival, which I actually did not realize before I watched these documentaries, was actually originally created to promote an app that Billy McFarland and Ja Rule work on together, where essentially it was an app to book talent. It was an easier way to get in contact with artists and request them to perform at private events. So, I didn't even realize that was happening before this. But Ja Rule essentially just created that same app, and it's now called Icon, and moved on and faced no legal repercussions other than he's a defendant in the class action lawsuit.
I will say I think it's hilarious that the new app is called Icon and it's spelled with two N's as in like I con people out of their money, but I don't know. Like, it's just one of those oddly poetic parts of the story to me. But yeah, go on with what you were saying.
But yeah, so I thought it was interesting to also just to hear from the event planners and how basically, you know, every single day they were basically just living out like a nightmare because they knew what they were doing wasn't going to be possible. You know, just like trying to secure housing. Even though you know the housing is going to be nothing like what you advertised, you would easily need to provide something for people to sleep in. You know, trying to secure catering, trying to secure, you know, a reasonable stage package for the decently high-level artists that they managed to secure to perform.
And I think all of that, too, was a testament to just how good Billy McFarland was at selling people on stuff and manipulating people. Because he was able to get experienced event planners to sign on and help him with this. He was, like, there was one particular guy whose name I do not remember. He's the one who says something about being the yoga instructor for...
Mark Weinstein.
See, Jess is good with names. That would... and he even said that when he first heard about this event, him and a lot of the other people in the industry thought it was a joke, and they laughed. They were like, yeah, no way you can pull that off in 6 months. And then yet somehow Billy still got him to sign on to work for it. And I think that that's another kind of interesting thing, and kind of, like I said, when we talk about, like, I know I'm being more sympathetic to, like, the Instagram influencers and some of the attendees, but I'm like, when this guy was able to get people with years of experience in event planning to sign on and say, like, oh yeah, this could happen, we can make this work, you know, who can blame kind of the average spoiled brat millennial for kind of getting duped by that same guy? And I think that that was, like, another thing that I found super duper fascinating. I also am going to rewind a little bit to when you were talking about Fuck Jerry deleting comments. Because I do social media marketing professionally. You are not supposed to do that. That is, like, one of, like, deleting comments is just a bad policy all around. And I think they even, the Hulu one has someone who's, like, a professional social media specialist that is, like, all of these are terrible marketing procedures. That, because some of these comments, too, were also just, like, not even necessarily negative, but just, like, legitimate questions about logistics. Things like, you know, hey, where am I supposed to go? Like, what time is my flight to the Bahamas? And they were told, like, oh, no, delete that, because we can't have anyone seeing what a hot mess this is. And social media can be, like, a really, really wonderful thing, I think, both for personal and marketing purposes. But the problem, I think, with the FIRE people is they definitely saw social media as a one-way street. They saw it as, we can use this to just sort of throw a bunch of content out into the universe, but we don't have to use it to, like, answer questions or respond to our followers or do anything. Even when some of the people did start tweeting and saying, like, this is nothing like what was promised to us, I think some of them were getting, like, cease and desist letters and being told, like, no, you're not allowed to tweet about the festival. You're not allowed to, like, show people what's really happening down here. And I think it's a really good lesson to anyone who's doing social media marketing that sort of other side of listening to your customers is just as, if not more important than the content that you put out yourself. And this is, like, just, it's a illustrative of what happens when you try to treat social media like it's that sort of one-way communication channel and not the two-way channel that it is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm sorry. I just had a point, so I had to rewind a little bit.
No.
Sorry.
So yeah, Fire Festival, cautionary tale for the millennial generation.
Yeah, and social media marketing.
Specifically the wealthy millennial generation.
Yeah. And anyone who wants to work
poor millennials already knew about that shit.
Yeah. Poor millennials already knew about that shit. Also, if you can afford to go to this festival, I highly encourage you to instead simply fly to the Bahamas on your own time and give them some of your thousands of dollars, because a bunch of Bahamian locals, like, were working, you know, probably 20-hour days and not getting paid. So, if any good comes out of this that the rich millennials can provide, please, please, please go to the Bahamas and stimulate this economy and tip generously and give these people the money that they deserve. That is my plea to you, wealthy millennials.
And hate Billy McFarlane and Ja Rule Forever for their exploitation of Bahamian workers.
Yeah. And this has been somewhat qualified
yes.
with Anne and Jess.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.